Welcome to Let's Talk ETFs. I'm your host, Jonathan Liss, and I've been closely tracking the ETF space for more than 13 years through a variety of roles here at SeekingAlpha.com. Each week, a different guest and I will take an in-depth look at a particular aspect of the rapidly evolving exchange-traded fund space, with a focus on how investors can best utilize ETFs to reach their investing goals. Before we begin, a brief disclaimer. This podcast is for entertainment and educational purposes only. Nothing said here should be taken as investment advice. All opinions expressed on this show are those of the individuals expressing them alone. A full set of disclosures will be included at the end of this show. You can subscribe to Let's Talk ETFs on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. Welcome back. I trust everyone's holidays were great. As a reminder, if you've been enjoying this podcast, you should go and leave us a five-star rating, and if you can, a written review on the podcast platform of your choice, as it really does help other investors discover this show. We've got some great shows planned for you in the coming year, wishing all of our listeners much success in 2021. For reference purposes, this show is being recorded on the morning of Tuesday, December 22nd, 2020. My guest today is Dodd Kitsley, Director of Davis Advisors. Since 2016, Dodd has been responsible for the growth and development of Davis's ETF business, which now comprises four transparent active ETFs with total AUM of over $1 billion. Before joining Davis, he was head of ETF strategy and national accounts at Deutsche Bank. And before that, he was global head of ETP research at BlackRock. Dodd has also served as director of ETF strategy and research at SSGA, as well as a VP at Morgan Stanley. He holds the CFA designation. He is a graduate of Hamilton College and has an MS in sports psychology from the University of Houston. Anyway, enough of an intro. Welcome to the show, Dodd. It's great to have you here.
It's great to be here, Jonathan. Thanks so much.
And thank you for taking the time the week of Christmas to talk to me. I know people often have family obligations, although perhaps this year things are a little different, as we were discussing before the show. Obviously not going to be all that much traveling happening, unfortunately. It is what it is in terms of the situation, and hopefully by this time next year, things will look very, very different.
We're very hopeful as well. As our chairman says, 2020 is the year where the term unprecedented has become a cliche. So, yeah.
Absolutely. So you've been in the ETF space really since the very early days, including at really the biggest firms in terms of assets under management. So first of all, how do you end up in the ETF space? And then once you had been in the space for a while at those really large firms, what made you decide to join a much smaller family style firm like Davis?
Sure. Yeah, I've been unbelievably fortunate in my career to have stumbled on ETFs back in the late 90s. And at the time, I was a young research analyst following closed-end funds. And the ETF space was very small at the time. It was less than 32 products and less than $40 billion in assets. And long story short, helped launch the first ETF research team on Wall Street, and really feel just incredibly lucky, because to be able to talk about a product in a structure that can create so much value and so much good for the investment community really truly has been an honor. I started doing research at Morgan Stanley and realized pretty short along that I was really interested in the nuts and bolts of how these things work, and really wanted to get on the asset management side. So, you know, to your point, I joined some of the largest ETF providers in the world at State Street and at iShares, and had a wonderful, wonderful experience there.
I believe at the time you were at State Street, it was the largest firm, correct?
Yes. Yes, it was. And then, iShares went through really exponential growth while I was there. So I get to see a lot in terms of product development, the development of kind of the capital markets teams in the whole structuring and trading and all of the different parts of the ecosystem, which was an unbelievable experience, particularly for somebody who serves in a role that primarily educates around, you know, ETFs, their advantages, possible pitfalls, those sort of things. So to have that knowledge and that kind of view into the inside of the inner workings of ETFs was really invaluable, and I feel very lucky to have had that.
Sure. And then, so how did you end up at Davis? I'm sure there's an interesting story there also.
There definitely is, particularly because, you know, my entire career had really been more focused on the index side of things. The obviously industry has changed a lot, and you know, the myth that ETFs are just about indexing has been largely dispelled, though we're still working on that. But when I joined Davis,
sure. I mean, I suppose it wasn't a myth when it was started. It was ETFs were essentially synonymous with indexes for the first probably decade and a half or so. Obviously,
so much
things
so.
Have changed quite a bit since then.
Yeah, and they're really just starting to change. But yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, there's still not a lot of active out there. And that's one of the reasons why I joined Davis is here is a firm that is time tested in the active side of things. It's been around for 51 years and has very thoughtful approach to active management. So to be able to offer active management in an ETF was something that really excited me. It's where I see the puck going for the industry. Actively managed strategies are going to be the next catalyst for growth in the ETF industry. And we've really seen that in 2020 as more and more active managers have entered the space, particularly now that there is a semi-transparent, several semi-transparent structures available and tested and viable. But yeah, the reason one I joined Davis was that it was just an exciting opportunity to bring active strategies to the ETF space. And Davis was among the first to be able to do that in actively managed equity strategies, which was even more exciting to really be part of a firm that was being a pioneer in the space. The other reason I joined, you know, really was the culture at Davis and the philosophy that our firm has as an active manager. And, you know, I entered this being really a doubting Thomas on active management. Again, being an evangelist for indexing, seeing really the indexing side of things for, you know, a couple decades, you know, I was very skeptical in active management. And Davis really checked the box, all the boxes in terms of what one should look for in a good active manager, you know, a firm that charges reasonable fees, that's really focused in research driven, that offers portfolios that are very differentiated and benchmark agnostic. You know, there's so much on the active side that's closet indexing, which is hopefully going away because of the ETF industry and largely has. We've seen the writing on the wall there. Davis isn't like that. We offer very, very differentiated portfolios. And then most importantly, you know, a firm that really eats its own cooking. You know, we're invested alongside investors. So a lot of admirable traits for an active manager that kind of prior to joining Davis, I was very skeptical at large on the active management industry overall.
So I'd love to get into the Davis approach to active management and active management in an ETF wrapper a bit. If you could delve in a bit more to what makes the approach unique, and I guess particularly discuss what the research process looks like and how you end up with funds that are benchmark agnostic. As you say, many actively managed mutual funds and really many hedge funds even, you know, maybe charge an arm and a leg, but at the end of the day, you're getting, you know, 95% beta overlaps with whatever the benchmark is, S&P 500 or Russell 2000. So what is Davis's approach more specifically, and how do you go about the research process?
Our approach is, again, time tested. The firm formally has been around for 51 years, but we trace our roots back to Shelby Davis, who began investing in the 1940s. So this is an investment discipline that certainly has evolved over time, but has rung true to its core beliefs and principles. Our belief is, you know, we look for companies that are durable, resilient, adaptable, those with very strong management teams, those that can weather storms through full economic cycles. Then, you know, we're looking for companies that can grow their earnings in a reliable way over a long cycle. We take a very long-term approach. We have relatively low turnover. In fact, lower turnover than a lot of the indexes out there, because we do deep research, boots on the ground, visiting the companies, visiting the management teams, seeing how they allocate capital, capturing something that a stock screen really can't. So we certainly do look at the quantitative, but we look a lot at the qualitative as well, which again can't be captured in a smart beta strategy or just a regular index type of approach. And then we certainly do have a very strong value discipline as well, where we're trying to enter into companies that are trading below their long-term value based on long-term earnings power. So a lot of folks put us in the value bucket, but we're really more of a very selective, we have a very selective research process. It's more of a blend in the large cap space overall. And our research team has been together for nearly 20 years. We have one investment discipline that we apply to different kind of segments of the market, depending on how advisors and investors want to allocate. But it's been one Davis discipline that has continued to be enhanced over the years, but is very selective. A couple things that may help in kind of understanding our approach. We look at, when we buy stocks, we look at buying the entire business through that type of lens. We say often that we don't rent stocks. We're here to buy businesses, and buy businesses that, again, are going to be durable, that are going to be able to grow over long market cycles and be compounding machines. The other lens I think that's interesting to look at us is, you know, when you look at our ETFs, we have 25 to say 31 holdings in those ETFs. We strongly believe that what you don't own is as important as what you do own. So we are highly selective. We are very benchmark agnostic. There are entire countries in our global ETFs that we don't own. There are sectors in the US market that we don't own. So we're really trying to pick the best businesses in whatever market segment we're looking at.
Yeah, I was going to say, I was just glancing at the fact sheet for DUSA, which is your U.S. large cap fund. And on the fact sheet, you are benchmark agnostic. Of course, you do cite the composition of the S&P 500. And this is clearly not something which is a closet S&P 500 fund. As of the end of October, which is when the fact sheet is from, I see that DUSA has 43% an allocation to financials versus just 11% S&P 500. And then on the other side of things, just 5% of an allocation to information technology versus 26%. So you're definitely making very targeted bets here. There's 23 holdings in a slice of the market that people generally hold 100 or 500. Different holdings. And so, yeah, definitely a unique and interesting approach. And I want us to delve into it a little deeper in a bit. But before we get into that, I was just curious, you hear a lot of the arguments made around the new semi-transparent active ETFs that have been launched. You referred to the some of the different approaches that are out there, the Precidian model, Fidelity, Blue Tractor. There's five in total I believe. Mm-hmm. And the arguments that you'll often hear from firms like Fidelity and American Century that have gotten into this side of the business this year about why they chose to go the semi-transparent route is concerns around concepts or things like front-running, people piling into positions before they can establish a full position and pushing the price up, which obviously hurts their long-term performance, protection of intellectual property. They spend obviously a lot of money on research. Why is this not a concern for Davis?
Yeah, it's a real important question, you know, and we looked at all the different potential structures at the time over 5 years ago when we began this journey of, you know, bringing the best ETF product for investors available. And, you know, our conclusion was we didn't need the semi-transparent structure. It was kind of an unnecessary cost and an unnecessary give up of one of the benefits, which matters to many investors, certainly not all, of being able to know what you own. And, you know, I think that transparency is very important. And there was really no need for us to go into the semi-transparent structure. The reason for that, and there's several, but the first, probably the most important, is just the nature of the way we manage money. We take a very long-term approach, low turnover. Again, we already mentioned lower turnover in general than a lot of indexes out there. And we invest primarily in large liquid securities. So the concern around front running of trades to us really was not realistic and not valid. You know, we've grown our suite of four ETFs to over $1 billion, been able to accommodate some extremely large trades, some in excess of $40 to $50 million in a single trade, without any negative effects, negative experiences from an execution or a front-running concern perspective. So we've got a long track record of it working and working incredibly well. But really, you know, we get why other active managers that may be higher turnover, that invest in less liquid securities, which may take a lot longer to scale in or out of a position, could be of why they'd want to wait until recently when the semi-transparent structures came out. We felt like we really didn't need to. You know, another reason why, you know, we came out with ETFs, active ETFs in a traditional ETF structure is the firm has a culture of transparency. You know, we believe that investors should know what they own. There's no reason to keep it a secret, whether it's, you know, 15 or 30 days or 3 months in arrears. You should know what your portfolio holds. And the traditional ETF structure preserves that. You know, we are delivery vehicle agnostic. We offer SMAs. So if you really want to know our trades prior to, you know, our ETFs coming out, you just needed to open an SMA account and you would see the trades as they occur. I guess the other thing is, you know, we're a boutique asset manager, you know, 23, 24 billion in assets across all our strategies, but we're not ginormous and we're able to get in and out of positions, those being large cap stocks, very seamlessly. So we're very comfortable with the traditional ETF structure. Fortunate that you know, we were able to get a 3.5 to 4 year head start on some of the active equity ETFs in the space, and are very excited to be here.
Yeah, sure. I guess if you're well down off with Fidelity Contra Fund, maybe the front running concern is a little different. But yeah, the point is taken. And in terms of what you're saying about transparency, you know, I certainly like to be able to look in real time almost, or, you know, 24 hours later or less, and know exactly what's in each of the funds that I'm holding. I think the semi-transparent funds are a step forward by and large in that they don't make investors wait 90 plus 60 or up, yeah, up to 4 or 5 months if trades were made at the very beginning of a quarter, so that they are releasing holdings 15 or 30 days later. I think just, you know, thinking about it, One additional advantage of having full transparency or as close to it as possible is that it eliminates the kind of bad behaviors and incentives that you've often seen in things like the mutual fund industry. So, you know, we're closing in on the end of 2020 here. By the time people listen to this, it'll be early 2021. But there is this desire among people that get to report holdings much later to be able to show, oh yeah, we were in all of these top performers. And so you have the desire to, for example, to window dress at the end of quarters or the end of years. If you don't have transparency, you can kind of get away with that. And that's not necessarily the best strategy in terms of performance or in terms of being in and out of positions for the right incentives. So having full transparency certainly eliminates the possibility of things like window dressing that have been very traditional in the mutual fund industry. So just, I think, another cap in the feather of firms like yours that are doing the active thing fully out in the open.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. And hey, we're so excited that the semi-transparent is out and that more and more folks, more and more asset managers are getting into the space. And hey, to be honest, you know, we have a a multi-cap strategy, and we don't have that in an ETF format because, you know, we could have had, you know, some of the more front-running concerns with the very less liquid securities in the small cap space. So we totally get it, and we welcome and are so encouraged by more folks getting into the active equity ETF space because it gives more credibility to the category. I can't tell you how many people over the last 3 to 4 years have been, asked me, well, you know, what indexes do your ETFs track? And again, it's getting over that myth that we talked about, and I think opening remarks, that ETFs, you know, don't have to be based on a independent third-party reference index, but all too many investors, I think, still have that stuck in their minds. So it'll be really exciting to see some great managers get into this space and have the investment community recognize how powerful the ETF structure, whether it be transparent or semi-transparent, can be for them in delivering an active strategy.
Do you have plans at Davis to go the semi-transparent route with maybe funds that target smaller cap stocks or maybe less liquid markets, emerging or you know, different kind of foreign markets that maybe even a smaller fund could theoretically move the needle in ways you wouldn't want to have to disclose immediately at the end of the trading day?
Yeah, you know, we're open to all, you know, innovations and new structures. We're not tied to any specific one. You know, that being said, no plans at this time. We are very focused place. All of our strategies have been around for more than a decade. In the case of our large cap strategy, 51 years plus, financial closing in on 30. But we're not a product manufacturer at Davis. That's a big difference from some of the big firms that I've worked to in the past, where you're always looking for kind of the next great new product or idea, which at times can be great and well-serving for the investment community. And other times it's kind of following the hot dot. But we're very focused on being equity specialists and being equity specialists in the categories that we play in and have had decades and decades of experience. So long-winded way of saying, you know, we don't have a product development committee. We're not, you know, trying to roll out all these different new products or strategies. We're real happy with the four that we have and want to continue to educate and deliver outperformance and deliver value in the strategies that we have currently.
Sure. Makes total sense.
With so many ETFs to choose from, how do you find the ones that are best for your portfolio? Personally, I always start my ETF searches with Seeking Alpha's ETF Screener, a product I came up with and helped build in 2015. Utilizing Seeking Alpha's proprietary ETF taxonomy system and powered by data from Morningstar and CapIQ, the ETF screener now has a greatly improved user interface. Try the brand new data sliders, allowing you to create much more granular screens and locate the funds that best match your investing style and risk tolerance. I have personally built my own ETF portfolio, as well as my three kids' college saving plans and my parents' non-tax deferred ETF portfolios, starting with Seeking Alpha's ETF screener each time. And what's best, Seeking Alpha's ETF screener is totally free to use. So why not give the ETF screener a try today by going to seekingalpha.com and typing the words ETF screener into the search bar at the top of the site. The Seeking Alpha marketplace offers something for every type of investor. Find the investing community that best suits your style, needs, and risk profile. So what are you waiting for? Go to seekingalpha.com/marketplace to learn more.
All right, so I'd love to get back into the specifics on your four funds here. And the four funds are for people that want to go research them more. Your largest fund is the $330 million Davis Select Worldwide ETF, DWLD. Then there's the $310 million Davis Select U.S. Equity ETF, ticker symbol DUSA. Easy one to remember. I guess they both are. One of the nice things about ETFs is definitely the ticker symbols. Is the $270 million Davis Select International ETF, DINT. Then there's the $150 million Davis Select Financial ETF. The performance on the funds has been quite good this year, and particularly more recently relative to passive benchmarks like the S&P 500 or the All Country World Index. And I'd love to get into the specific stock picking approach your portfolio managers are taking here. So first, starting more broadly, is it the same across all four funds, i.e. are you using some kind of a value quantitative overlay and then getting that boots on the ground deep dive research, or does each fund have its own unique approach when it comes to picking specific holdings and position sizing and all the rest?
It's a great question. So the answer really is we have one investment discipline and one philosophy in terms of what we look for in a business, in a company that we're going to purchase. We've got one team that works very cohesively. Certainly our analysts can be specialists in certain areas and are, but we work together cohesively as a single research team. So the cuts, the individual products, if you will, are more reflective of the way that advisors and investors want to kind of consume our investment discipline, with a focus on, say, large cap US, financial specifically, global, which is our, you know, most unconstrained, or worldwide DWLD is our most unconstrained portfolio, or more of a pure play on international with DINT. So it is one team. You'll see sometimes common holdings in different ETFs, but it's really reflecting the overall Davis investment discipline, and our best ideas in each segment is delineated by kind of the name and the objective there.
Yeah, sure. And in terms of overall approach here, is this really a fully bottom-up approach in terms of one position at a time, or are there some macroeconomic considerations going into things also? So for example, you look ahead and you see that it looks like we're heading into some kind of a global recession. All right, I'm going to avoid the energy sector right now. Does that come into play at all, or is it really just a fully bottoms-up approach?
Yeah, I'll stay on the fence here, leaning sure. Very, very heavily in terms of it is fully bottom up. It really is. We certainly do look at macro trends. We're looking at, you know, where are their headwinds, where are their tailwinds, in particular industries. In terms of looking at countries, we look at things like rule of law and stability and things of that nature. So, but it really is getting to know the companies and creating portfolios of the best businesses and the best long-term stock opportunities within each segment. You know, an example of, you know, a trend is like, look, you know, the e-commerce market, particularly the e-commerce market in China, has such immense opportunity. So certainly that drives us to look, you know, at companies like Alibaba and JD.com and even taking it, you know, further to really kind of get to know that industry, which we want to find the best companies within there. But it drives us to get to know more opportunities within areas where we see, you know, multi-decade tailwinds in opportunity.
Yeah, sure. That's well put. And I'm just looking at the holdings of some of the funds here. So looking at DUSA, for example, I love that you have Alphabet and Amazon mixed in with New Oriental Education and Technology, right? You know, side by side, slightly different position sizes, but really everything you're taking here is a very directed bet, it seems like, in all of these funds. So in terms of turnover, how much turnover is there? You said there's very little. I'm just curious if you could quantify how little there is. And then, you know, obviously one of the big advantages of the ETF structure is that it's not a pooled investment. So you as an individual investor decide when to create a taxable event for yourself, unlike in mutual funds where selling by others in the fund can create a taxable event for you. And then of course, in-kind transactions and, you know, the more assets you have in your funds, theoretically, at least the more you can avoid end of year taxable events. So how do the funds look from a taxation perspective? Have you ever had to pay out end of year capital gains before?
Yeah, so we did in our initial year, but we've not paid capital gains last year or this year. So the structure certainly has played out to our advantage. To your point, other shareholder activity, the cash flows that can result, particularly on the redemption side, don't trigger capital gains events. That being said, you know, if there are changes within the portfolio where you're selling a position at a gain, that can create a capital gains event. Generally, it's more de minimis than you'd see in a similar mutual fund structure due to the in-kind opportunities that that we do have. And but yeah, our track record's been very, very strong for all four of our ETFs making zero capital gains in many years and de minimis ones in the others in our 3.5 to 4 year history. Jonathan, you asked about turnover. It certainly you know, varies by year. We don't want to give the impression this is kind of a set it and forget it type of portfolio. We are constantly making tweaks in our positions, adding new ones, eliminating others. The typical turnover in our strategies longer term, which again is kind of the chassis in which, you know, this ETF is built upon and a delivery vehicle for, has been around 15 to 30%. Per year, depending on the strategy and depending on, you know, the market environment. You know, we were doing a lot of positioning, might not have been so much new names and names exiting the portfolios, and we use DUSA as an example, but we're taking some money off the table in some of the high flyers and the great returners that we saw in the Alphabets and Amazons of the world, and allocating to areas of the market where position size might not have been quite as big at the time of great opportunities in select financial companies like Wells Fargo and US Bancorp and JP Morgan. And I think the timing's been certainly good so far, as we've seen a bit of a turn there. But it is a very actively managed portfolio, but our goal is to really find businesses that are going to be long-term compounders over long, long periods of time. We certainly have a sell discipline in there. It's a lot different than I think a lot of active managers that might have a shorter term time horizon. We're not really assigning particular, say, price targets to certain companies, but we are looking at kind of, you know, where is their valuation relative to their long-term earnings potential.
Sure. And then I was kind of curious about this. So three of your funds, US, the World, and the International ex-US Fund, very broad in scope, of course. You also have one sector fund, a financials fund. And I was curious why particularly launch a financials focused fund. Is that a specific expertise for Davis? Are there plans to launch other types of sector funds also?
Yeah, it's a great question. And for those that don't know Davis over the years, it has been a core competency for the firm. Chris Davis, our chairman, his grandfather began investing in financial stocks back in the 1940s. But it's been a part of our core competency throughout the history of the firm. Chris launched our financial mutual fund, which is an analog to DFNL. It's similar, not exactly the same. But he launched that 30 years ago and has an incredibly strong track record, both relative to the S&P 500 and certainly relative to the S&P Financials Index. So it's an area where we know well. We think it's an area of the market that is often very misunderstood. So it's an area where we think we can add tremendous amount of value in providing expertise and providing a investment vehicle in which to participate in financials.
Yeah, sure. And let me know if this question is too prying. I'm going off the cuff here, but just curious. And I know you weren't at Davis at the time, but just curious how the firm was able to weather the 2008-2009 global financial crisis. Obviously, any part of that sector would have been a bad place to be over those years. Even the best performing stocks in the financials got just absolutely eviscerated over that period. And just curious if Davis kind of saw the writing on the wall and saw things coming, or if was as blindsided as everybody else by what ended up unfolding there.
Yeah, it certainly was in a time, going back to the financial crisis, where expertise and experience plays out. And certainly, as you point out, no one could avoid the downside in the financial sector overall. But it was one, and maybe taking a step back, financials overall is such a diverse, it's the most diverse sector in any market. You've got insurance companies, you've got asset managers, you got big banks, you got regional banks. The list goes on and on. So it's a very diverse segment of the market. And that's an area where active management selectivity really, really matters. There are other areas of the market you could argue maybe not as much, but financials to us is an area where that expertise really can play out. And, without citing specific numbers, we certainly, took our lumps like anyone else invested in financials during the financial crisis. But on the way back up, we certainly had a disproportionate participation in strong performance coming out of the financial crisis because of our, real emphasis again on long-term investment, on investing in companies that are durable, adaptable, resilient, that have the ability to withstand challenging environments. And financial crisis was certainly a big one. 2020 is certainly another one. And that's one where we think, in kind of segmenting this to kind of current opportunities, we think that a lot of investors are still, hung up and have misperceptions based upon the financial crisis. And financial companies today are far stronger, have much stronger balance sheets, are better businesses to kind of come out of a challenging environment than they were back in the financial crisis.
Yeah, sure. That's well put. So I guess I'd love to stay on financials for a second here. And again, you are quite overweight financials in the Davis Select U.S. Equity ETF, ticker symbol DUSA. This has obviously been a very beaten down sector. I think definitely there's always the concern that, you know, if it happened last time, it could happen again. And the reality is, reading people like Taleb's Black Swan, you're very unlikely to get hit with the same style meltdown or financial crisis twice in a row. And so that concern does seem misplaced. On the other hand, though, the U.S. seems to be headed, if not exactly to where Japan has been for 40 years and Europe for maybe a decade at this point, certainly to an environment with a relatively flat yield curve and with a perennially low rate environment. And that has traditionally been quite bad for firms in the financial space that rely on consumer lending, business lending, really just anything that involves borrowing at a low cost and lending it out at a higher cost. And I'm just wondering what Davis is seeing in the sector that leads you to be as overweight as you are in financials right now.
Yeah, you know, to us, the market is pricing a lot of these companies as if they're going out of business. They're pricing them, multiples in the low, in the high rather, single digits to low double digits. And financials as a whole is, trading at a forward PE of 14.4 compared to the market of 22. So we're see folks, pricing financials in a dire scenario where they're only accounting for 4 or 5 years of earnings, and the company's just not making it through. And financials are in a much better position from a balance sheet perspective. The financial crisis was one where it was an unfortunate event, but it was one where financial companies really learned and became much more conservative and took a much more, conservative credit culture. It was not as easy now to get a mortgage or get a loan than it was prior to the financial crisis, right?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose there's probably somewhat of a Darwinian element here too, in that the companies that were just total cowboys all seem to go under. So whoever was left standing, maybe other than a couple of too big to fail firms like Citi, sure, who were just straight up bailed out. But many of the firms that did manage to pull through, the Wells Fargos, the JP Morgans, seem to have been less leveraged and more conservative than some of their counterparts that went under there. So, point taken.
Absolutely. With the accounting, the companies have been this year, marking 100% of their loan losses. The financial companies are marking 100% of their loan losses, expected loan losses, immediately on current earnings. So we're seeing a very depressed earnings level, which, should that not come to fruition, will go back into earnings and create it's not lost earnings. It's earnings it's accounted for and set aside for loan losses. So we see certainly a catalyst there, as well as, a recognition that, look, rates, we don't know where rates are going to go. Rates can remain low, but these companies can be profitable at very low rates. And should they rise, that's a further catalyst for growth and opportunity and earnings there.
Sure. And certainly if you look at some of the segments that have been worst hit by the virus and by the global financial slowdown or really depression in many cases, not just recession that hit earlier this year and that we're still seeing the after effects of and will well into 2021, 2022, you're looking at industries like travel, like hospitality, like entertainment. These are some very capital heavy businesses. And so you have to imagine that there's going to be a lot of borrowing coming up in the future when things finally do turn around and entrepreneurial individuals and companies see opportunities to fill in many of the holes that have been left by what's going on. So it's definitely a perspective to keep in mind also when looking at financials and not just saying, well, they've been a terrible laggard, so I'm going to continue to underweight them forever. That works until it doesn't.
Yeah. And there's some great, you know, dominant, well-run financial companies that have the opportunity to really gain share, and they're strong. They're positioned to weather the storm, whether it's, you know, for another year or another 3 years, you know. And I think a stat we like to kind of throw out that just really shows the misperception around financials is you look back to 2010 and financials share of S&P market cap was around, you know, 18%. Today it's around 12. Look at earnings. Financial share of S&P 500 earnings in 2010 was around 14. It's close to 20 right now. So their share of the earnings, even though they're depressed earnings, is grown considerably. Yet, you know, the market cap and the dislocation between price and value is never more apparent than it is right now in financials, in our opinion.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Anyway, I recommend listeners, if they want to research this more, go take a look at Davis's website, and particularly at some of the literature and the fact sheet for DFNL. I find the holdings list very interesting there, what you're overweighting, what you're underweighting relative to the broader benchmark there. Before we wind things down here, I was just curious what Davis's future plans in the ETF space are. Do you have other funds that you're currently working on? Do you have plans to launch other funds in the not too distant future?
We don't. You know, as mentioned, we talked about earlier, we're not a product manufacturer. We, you know, are a very focused, research-driven shop, trying to, you know, deliver value where we know we can, and recognize that we can't be all things to all people. So yeah, our four ETFs is, you know, where our current plan is to further support advisors, provide more education on those, and, you know, continue to grow awareness of the four ETFs we currently have, but nothing in the pipeline. Though you can never say that's for certain for the long term, but at least for now.
Sure, yeah, makes sense. I mean, I do see some mutual funds here that I'd love to see active Davis versions of, real estate and government bonds, for example. So perhaps investors will have to wait a bit longer while you continue to focus on doing a great job with what you already have. Anyway, Dodd, this has been really, really excellent. What's the best place for listeners to want to continue researching everything we've been discussing here today?
Yeah, probably the best place is our website. So davisetfs.com. And there is just a host of information on the portfolios. There is information on the Wisdom of Great Investors, which is a series that we put out on investor behavior and the importance of controlling emotions. There's videos from both Chris and Danton. So that's really your one-stop shop and a great starting point. The other thing we would encourage financial advisors out there to reach out to their Davis representative. Their names are on the website as well as our 800 number. So we're here to serve our clients, to educate, to be a resource for you. So that's probably the best place to start.
Dodd, I want to thank you for coming on the show and being so generous with your time. I want to wish you a great 2021 and best of luck in everything you're doing over at Davis. Keep up the good work.
Right back at you, and thanks so much for having us.
For disclosures, Dodd Kitsley is long DWLT DUSA DINT and DFNL. Jonathan List doesn't have positions in any of the stocks or funds discussed in today's show. If you've been enjoying Let's Talk ETFs, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. And if you find this podcast useful, please consider leaving a review on one of those platforms so that other investors can discover it. You can also find this podcast on SeekingAlpha.com by typing Let's Talk ETFs into the search bar at the top of the site.